Protests over the death of George Floyd reached major cities across South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Time has come for us to make a change, and if I can take a stance in this walk, I will.
Hundreds of protesters marched through I-95 and into parts of downtown Miami on Saturday. It was peaceful for most of the day until things get out of hand. Eventually, demonstrators clashed with police. This also happened in Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach. We'll take a look at what happened this weekend and if there are more planned for the days ahead. Also, today is the start of the 2020 hurricane season, and we may already have the third named storm about to form. What can we expect from the upcoming season? Finally, today is also the reopening of the Florida Keys. We're going to go to Key West to hear from Mayor Terry Johnston about how they plan on protecting people while also welcoming more. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm Beach were among 140 cities across the country where protesters took to the streets this weekend. The protests were in response to the death of George Floyd, a black man in Minneapolis that was killed by a white officer while in custody. Interactions between protesters and police were largely peaceful during the day. However, in the evening, there were reports of police firing tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowds. And there have also been reports of damage and vandalism, with Bayside Marketplace in downtown Miami, some of the stores there looted on Saturday night. Curfews are in order in Miami-Dade, Broward, and West Palm Beach. In Fort Lauderdale, a police officer has been suspended after a video showed him pushing a kneeling woman to the ground on Sunday. And Attorney General William Barr has deployed federal riot teams to Miami. The Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles was covering the protest Saturday in Miami, and she joins us now to talk about it. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
What did you see when you first arrived, for the demonstrations in downtown Miami on Saturday?
Well, when we first arrived, things were calm. You had a small crowd, just a couple of hundreds that were gathered at the Torch of Friendship. People were holding up signs. It was a very mixed crowd. A lot of, Hispanics, blacks, and some non-Latin whites, but mostly young. There were a few older people, but people were holding up signs, "I can't breathe." If you're not outraged, you're part of the problem. They were chanting, "No justice, no peace." And it was fairly calmed. And after a while, the protesters decided to march, and they then headed west. Toward the Miami City Police Department. Interesting enough, when the march started, you really didn't have that much of a police presence. The police just sort of hung back. There was a cruiser, at the end. And then when we got to the City of Miami Police Department, as you were turning the curve from the Children's Courthouse, there was a line of Miami-Dade police officers who were across the street, just keeping watch and telling people to stay on the other side of the sidewalk. And then there were City of Miami Police, the bicycle patrol. They were also there, and they were also just sort of, watching. Mayor Suarez was also there behind the racks. And after a few speeches and moment of silence in front of the police department, you did have some members of the crowd that went up and approached the mayor and the officers that were there, screaming, calling them, sellouts. But everything, remained calm. And even, the mayor, I asked him sort of his reaction to the day, and he noted the fact that it was a peaceful gathering and commended the protesters on that. And he understood, the frustrations and the reasons why they were out on Saturday.
Do we know who organized this? Was it the Black Lives Matter groups, other local groups, or?
Well, what we were told initially, the posting that went on social media said Southeast Save the Kids, which is an organization that works to end the incarceration of youth. But I spoke to a protester who was with Florida Majority, and he also identified himself as being among the organizers of this group.
There was another protest, too, in Miami. It was on Saturday. It was in Coral Gables, and it was a much smaller group out there. And also, it was, I believe, organized in conjunction with the police department, right?
Yes, Protest Miami. And that one, you know, created sort of a lot of buzz or criticism on social media because of the fact that the organizers did invite the police, I think 22 police chiefs, to be a part of that protest. And what they said is they wanted them to be part of the conversation. And it was intentional that they took it to an affluent neighborhood like Coral Gables. But that one was smaller and it was calmer, but it did get some you know, criticism on social media because of the way in which it was organized.
And I believe, is that also the one where we saw photos of some of the police officers getting down on one knee?
Yes. And it's just not in South Florida, too, because there were images, you know, while there's been a lot of focus on the violence that has erupted, but there have also been situations where police officers during these protests have either joined in with the crowd or they've also gotten down on one knee in support of the message and the outrage that's being expressed by protesters.
How do we explain that, you know, we had protests in over 140 cities? Was this a coordinated effort, or how do you explain when these things happen? Is it just something that grows organically on social media and then you see it happen?
I think it does. I think with social media today, you know, it makes it easy for things to grow organically. But I can tell you that there are people that I know in my circle who were asking, do you know if there's any protests that are happening in Miami because I need to get out or I need to take my kid to this. I you know, I need to do something. And so I think you got a lot of that. When I spoke to people during the protests on Saturday, I mean, what struck me again was it was young. And in cases where there were older individuals, it was a multi-generational crowd. I remember there was a young Hispanic girl, probably around the age of 16, and she had "I can't breathe" scrawled all over her arms and her legs, and her grandparents were out with her, and they were, you know, taking pictures of her. But there were, you know, older people who said they needed to come out because they had children, they had grandkids, and they needed to make a statement. And so there was a lot of that sort of organically seeing it on social media and people's own personal sense of outrage or need to do something, to be a part of something, to make a statement in some way.
Obviously, the strange thing about this protest is the fact that it's happening during a pandemic. So it's not, these are, again, as we always say, very strange times. And of course, you know, one of the things we've been told is we got to be very careful. Hard to be careful when a lot of people are in one area. I mean, first of all, from the photos I've seen, it looked like most people did have masks on.
Most people did have masks on, but social distancing went completely out the window.
Right.
People were basically standing shoulder to shoulder. And I asked people who I interviewed about their concerns about the pandemic. And folks told me, yeah, that was in the back of their mind, but the need to get out and to be a part of this and to make a statement was much more important for them. You did have people who, you know, had the mask. And as a journalist, I can tell you I had a face shield, I had a mask. I had gloves, I had sanitizer, just because I have to be careful. I have, you know, elderly parents, but it is something, you know, that's there at the forefront because we are having these marches during a pandemic that's ongoing. And we do have cases here in Florida and in Miami-Dade.
And, you know, did that affect your ability to be able to be a reporter? It could be challenging when you have to keep a distance from people.
It is a little challenging. I mean, you know, I've covered, you know, a number of protests and usually, you know, as a journalist, you're out there, you often get in the middle of the crowd and you're walking, you know, with people. But what you had to do was just sort of keep a safe distance. And also when you know, approach people, you know, I'm standing more toward, you know, the side and I'm not trying to be in the thick of things. For our photographers, of course, you know, they are there, they're capturing images. And again, I mean, given the environment today, just in terms of journalists and what you see happening in terms of journalists either being arrested or being tear gassed, you know, we have so many reasons to be careful and to be aware of our surroundings because of the tensions that are out there and what some of our colleagues have experienced as far as arrests and other incidents while covering these protests around the country.
Yes, that's one of the stories that has led nationally is that we've seen protesters and police attacking journalists in many of these protests around the country. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles. Again, multiple protests in South Florida in Miami-Dade over the weekend following the death of George Floyd. Again, the story of Mr. Floyd dying at the hands of police officers in Minneapolis. And you can see the coverage of the protests across South Florida from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale and Miami. Just go to WLRN.org. So, Jacqueline, everything seemed peaceful Saturday for the most part, but then things got a little out of hand. What happened?
Exactly. So, you know, when you're covering a protest, the thing that you're always mindful of is that things can turn pretty quickly. And so one of the things that happened, they walked over to Save Miami Police Department, and then they came back to the Torch of Friendship. And I remember the original flyer saying that the protest was going to be over at 6 o'clock. That was far from the case. And so soon after they got back to the Torch of Friendship, they decided to start marching again. And this time they headed south on Biscayne, and then they turned, and there was a police cruiser right there. And I will tell you that the police, for the most part, better half of this protest, were trying not to engage. They were not going to take debate. And there were people who were protesting who were also trying to keep the peace within the crowd, not letting protesters throw bottles or trying to just keep things calm. So as they're now heading north on Biscayne toward the Freedom Tower, when they got in front of the American Airlines Arena, they turned and then they headed west. Soon, there were messages on social media that said they were going to shut down I-95. And sure enough, when I got to I-95, 8th Street, the Overtown entrance ramp, you saw just a throng of people just blocking that ramp. And when you looked up, you saw that there were protesters that were up on the expressway, clearly stopping traffic. And then at the bottom, there was also a group that was at the bottom where on the west side with the police department. And then you had other protesters. So at this point, the protest is just sort of splintered out. You have a group that's headed back to the Torch of Friendship. You have a group on the ramp, another one actually on the expressway, and another one in front of the police station. Based on the interviews that I did and one of my colleagues who was also there, actually two of my colleagues, photographers that were there, one of the protesters or a couple of protesters were jumping on the police vehicles. And some of the protesters were actually trying to get him off, to stop doing this. And now one witness that I spoke to says that an officer, one of the police officers, fired tear gas. Other people say water bottles start flying. I mean, there's a lot of discrepancy in terms of who started it first. But this jumping on the police vehicle is sort of what lit the match in this. And soon after, you have tear gas that's being fired. Rubber bullets are being fired. Police cars are being attacked. I saw several cars where the windows were busted out by protesters. There were also police vehicles that had been set ablaze. And then we go into this standoff with the police. Somewhere probably around 9 o'clock, most of the protesters by now, they've dispersed. The police are on 4th. The protesters are on 5th. I'm on 6th. And you're watching this. And one of the incidents that I found disturbing was at one point, a young lady yelled out, you know, take a knee, take a knee, and was telling the protesters who were there to kneel. And they were kneeling. And then they started, you know, singing, chanting, no justice, no peace. And the police just started firing the tear gas. From where I stood, I didn't see anybody charging at them or anything. All they did was just took a knee on 5th. They were a block away, and the police just kept firing the tear gas. So eventually the protesters left, but by this time, Bayside is being looted, and we have the incidents there. And as I'm making my way toward Bayside, I ran into a couple of looters with, you know, their arms loaded with T-shirts, tags hanging out. You know, they're just walking. And then by the time I actually get to Bayside, you see garbage all over the place, garbage cans, you see busted windows.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, we had heard from some protesters as well. There was one in particular who shared his thoughts on why things get out of hand. This is a protester, Charles Durant Dandy Jr.
History repeats itself. That's a fact. In the past, we've tried peacefully protesting. Taking a knee didn't work. Peaceful protesting didn't work. Barack Obama didn't work. What works is stooping to their level and doing something that they can actually understand.
Jackie, you've covered protests in the past. Is this a refrain you'll hear from protesters?
I mean, you would hear this. I mean, listen, on Saturday, I would say that you had two groups. You had a group that was there early on, and it was peaceful. And the questions that I was asking, you know, protesters, why do you think things have worked out differently in Miami than we've seen in other cities that it's been peaceful? I mean, there really was a push for peacefulness, even while you did have some that were sort of trying to bait the cops, you know, calling them sellouts, calling them names, screaming at them. There were a lot of these signs. ACAB, that I understand may be a radical skinhead group. But by the time that sundown came, the crowd had turned a little bit, or most of the ones who were there early in the day had dispersed.
Yeah.
And now the environment had changed. And is it that the cops got tired of being calling names, or they became exasperated? Is it that the protesters just really pushed themselves, you know, too far? I mean, clearly what kept emerging was that within this protest, you had groups that were, you know, destroying the police vehicles and other protesters that were trying to stop them and even protect the cops from that, and
yeah.
Then you had the tear gas.
And there were obviously arrests both Saturday,
yes,
and Sunday. On Sunday, there were 35 arrests. I think on Saturday, a total of 57 people. And there have been conflicting reports about, you know, where those, who was arrested exactly. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, at the Miami Herald, we wrote a story where we basically said Miami-Dade Department of Corrections pointed out that 30 of the 57 are from Miami-Dade and 11 others have addresses in Broward or Palm Beach County. So this whole idea that the bulk of the people who were arrested were from out of town, I mean, doesn't hold up based on the information that corrections, you know, have.
Right. And Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez enacted a curfew that went into effect 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. How long is that on for?
That's where we're still trying to figure that one out, because that curfew actually came out of nowhere. And if you remember, we didn't really have a curfew around, you know, the pandemic. And so we're seeing this curfew in Miami-Dade. We're seeing this curfew also in the city of Miami, which is a little bit stricter. And I think, you know, when he issued the order, it was sort of open-ended. So we're waiting to see, you know, when will they lift that, you know, curfew. And I think a lot of that will probably depend on what happens today, in the next couple of days, maybe.
And just to make note that today was supposed to be the reopening of the beaches, he canceled that as well. We'll keep an ear out to see what changes with that. Are you aware of any more protest or demonstrations that are planned?
We are monitoring that today to see if, in fact, any more of these demonstrations start to take place. And as you mentioned earlier, in terms of social media and or things happening organically, I mean, social media has been a place where people are going, groups are, you know, getting their word out to them. Look, the frustrations are still there. Does it only come out on the weekends when people want to go and take the streets, or are they going to continue to march every day? We don't know. I mean, we know that this is a city, especially Miami, that has a history in terms of police brutality, in terms of these protests, something that we have to watch very carefully and, you know, and see how the authorities and the community, you know, address both of these issues so that things do not spiral out of control any more than they have.
And just to note that May was, it marked the 40th anniversary. This May marked the 40th anniversary of the McDuffie protests in Miami. And I mean, so it just, you think things change, they don't. It's, you know, it's almost like it's repeating itself.
And let's hope it doesn't really repeat itself, because if you recall, those were awful times in Miami's history. And we had Dolazano. I think we've had at least three of these protests, race riots, triggered by the involvement of police officers and black males. And so I think that people were aware. Those who are old enough to remember these incidents and who grew up in Miami, they were aware of that on Saturday. They mentioned that, and they really were hoping that things would not get to that point, but also very much aware that we still have work to do in terms of race and community relations in this city.
Jacqueline Charles is with the Miami Herald. Again, you can read more of her reporting on this weekend's protest on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus was at the protest in West Palm Beach. There was one there. Hundreds had gathered for peaceful protests in the afternoon. Now, he left before the reports came out of vandalism by some of the protesters later in the evening.
Tell me about what you saw when you arrived.
The march picked up steam in front of the West Palm Beach police station on Banyan Boulevard. And they eventually made their way through Rosemary Square, a shopping plaza, and stopped traffic at the intersection between Okeechobee Boulevard and Rosemary Ave. A black male and a white male protester decided to reenact what happened in Minneapolis. This time, the black man had his knee on the white man's neck.
Tell me a little bit more about what was going on there.
When they stopped the intersection, you saw the entire crowd get on one knee and put their fist in the air. They were gathering to do it and to do it fast. It was right in the middle of the road. And one of the organizers was pretty much kind of handling the crowd to make sure that people made way and got on their knees. And so that reenactment occurred so that everyone can see it happen. It was right smack in the middle of the street.
What was the police presence like?
The police presence was quite strategic. It wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't intimidating toward the protesters. They sort of kept their distance.
So you got the chance to speak to a couple of protesters. What did they tell you about why they were there?
So Amanda Demesman, she seemed like everyone else to point out the current and historical race issues plaguing the United States. The same sort of rallying cry we are seeing nationwide, particularly in regards to police brutality and what they view as an unfair justice system. Amanda, who was a black woman, told me that she just wants to be heard and told me she joined the peaceful protest to demand justice for George Floyd, raise awareness for other similar stories, and seek accountability from people in, quote, higher positions. She said, quote, black lives have been lost for senseless reasons.
We have Trayvon Martin, we have George Floyd, we have Breonna Taylor. The list goes on and on and on. We can't run, we can't walk, we can't talk, we can't have a play gun, we can't do anything. You can't even relax in your own home without being threatened. Time has come for us to make a change, and if I can take a stance in this walk, I will.
I also spoke to Gavin McClinton, one of the organizers. He said after he was done serving in the military, he felt the need to be an activist for this particular cause.
We get it. People are racist, and they're going to stay racist. But the real problem is with the judges and the juries that find these murderers not guilty. That's where our problem is, okay? If I can't go kill this man right here and get away with it, they shouldn't be able to do the same thing. And I would never want to kill you, my brother. I love you. But yeah, you feel me? Murder is murder, no matter who does it and what job they got.
From the people you spoke with, did anybody say anything about any of the protests around the country that had become violent, like the ones that happened in Miami?
From my understanding, there was a clear plan to keep this protest peaceful. When protesters stopped at the Myers Amphitheater, organizers and activists got on that stage and talked about the need to be more civic-minded, and they pled with the crowd to vote during the next election.
Wilkin, you know, you're a longtime resident of South Florida and of, you know, living in Palm Beach County. And I wondered, you know, have you ever seen or experienced the kind of unrest that you've seen these last few days?
No, I have not. This seems like it was a tipping point. One of the protesters said this was a series of events that led up to this. Whether it was racist interactions at a park in New York, the black jogger in Georgia. Protesters were mentioning a series of events that led up to the George Floyd incident in Minneapolis. And that 8-minute footage sort of sparked the unrest for a lot of people. And again, personally, I've never seen this before. It does seem like it's a tipping point, and I'm not quite sure where this is heading to.
Again, that was my conversation with WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. Now, again, he finished his reporting late in the afternoon, and there were reports that part of that crowd had gone off to disrupt traffic on the highway, and that another part of the crowd had also gone into downtown West Palm Beach. There were clashes with police. The West Palm Beach mayor had to order a curfew. We'll keep track of that story, and you can always find more of that coverage at WLRN.org. Well, still to come. Today is the start of the 2020 hurricane season, and storm number 3 is already forming. A conversation with the hurricane director is next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today is the start of the 2020 hurricane season. Forecasters say it's going to be above normal season. Currently, there's a system right now building up in the Gulf of Mexico that has a high chance of becoming possibly the third named storm of the year. It's the sixth straight year a named storm formed before the official start of the season. Add on top of that, we're still battling a pandemic and now an economic disaster. Well, we're joined now by the director of the National Hurricane Center to understand what kind of season we might expect. Kenneth Graham joins me now. Mr. Graham, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me on the program today.
Well, first of all, let's get an update on what's going on. What is the system in the Gulf of Mexico right now?
Yeah, this is a remnant system that came from the Pacific. It produced a whole bunch of rainfall, a couple feet of rainfall in some areas in Guatemala and El Salvador. That's part of our area of responsibility as well. So we worked over the weekend to communicate with them. But now it's, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, the upper level pattern looks conducive for development. And of course, the water temperatures are warm. So we think the remnants are going to get in the Gulf and then redevelop. So like you were saying, I mean, you're already dealing with so early, and we're dealing with our third potential of a third named storm.
And is it too early to tell what a potential path is for this storm?
Yeah, it's too early. And actually, it's interesting because the indicators now keep it in that area, just kind of meander around that same area. But what's interesting is it also spreads out an incredible amount of moisture all over the Gulf. So independent of development or not development, there's going to be some areas that see some precipitation this weekend into this coming weekend.
And there's also a system out in the Atlantic moving towards Bermuda. What's that one about?
Yeah, we're also watching that one as well. And it's, you know, you think about, you know, this early in the season, you know, we've already been looking at the Pacific. We're looking at the Atlantic. So that one there, you know, we don't think is going to be as much of a threat. So it's really the one in the Gulf that we're watching very, very closely.
So the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says we're going to have a busier than normal season, 13 to 19 named storms, 6 to 10 that could become hurricanes, 3 to 6 that could develop into a major hurricane. Okay. How am I supposed to view that kind of forecast? What am I supposed to take out of this?
And the way I look at it every single year, this is what I like to tell people. I mean, whether it's a busy season or not a busy season, you know, it only takes one. And I think preparation has to occur early. You have to prepare every single year as if you're going to be hit. And all the parameters are coming together for a busy season. When you look at the heat content of the oceans, you look at La Nina, which means a wind pattern over the Atlantic, basically that really doesn't have a lot of wind shear. So when they develop, they develop into storms and don't get the top tore off basically because of wind shear. And we're looking at another parameter, the African monsoon. We're going to see a lot of those tropical waves come off of Africa this August to September. So there's no one parameter that really makes or breaks a hurricane season. But if they all come together, then you can have a busy season. So the takeaway is this: be prepared. We got to prepare early. It looks to be an active season, above average season for us.
You know, we've seen storms that now are forming near land and very quickly. I mean, the tropical system Bertha, formed off the coast of South Carolina, again, just very quickly. What are the circumstances that are creating that kind of situation?
Yeah, we saw that last year too with Imelda. We had Olga. We had several systems last year and this year again. These are systems that, you know, that form really close to the coast. And I think we've got such good monitoring now with satellite and the data that we have. We can really pick up on those better than ever. And I think what's interesting about those is, you know, it's a big reminder that, you know, you can have situations about timelines. People, you know, a lot of times will think, well, like a Hurricane Florence, you have a lot of time to really watch these go across the ocean. You got 10 days notice. But there's other situations like Michael that you may have 3 or 4 days. So, yeah, it all depends on how far they form close to land. And the big takeaway is the timelines, you know, they could be a long timeline or a very short timeline. And that goes back to preparedness and being ready just in case.
I'm talking with the director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Kenneth Graham, and he's joining us via Skype. Again, as we mentioned, today is the start of the 2020 hurricane season. By the way, you can find all the things you need to know about preparing, because now is the time to prepare. You can just go to WLRN.org and get that information. Mr. Graham, you know, we're all living in this world. We have to adjust to a pandemic and stay-at-home orders, social distancing, etc. Many of us don't even get to work in the office anymore. But for you, how have things changed at the Hurricane Center? Are people still working at the center, or can they work from home? How has it changed your life?
Yeah, since this started, we've had a mixture of both. We've been able to activate our COOP plan to really look at an emergency situation and being able to have some folks work at home. We're 24 hours, whether a hurricane or not. You know, we have the marine forecast and responsibility for portions of the Atlantic going into the Pacific as well. So we have a mixture of some working at home and also here at the office. But for a hurricane, I just want to assure everybody, you know, we're going to be able to do the watches and warnings and the forecasts, you know, like we always do. We're going to have more people in the office. So we've taken steps to, you know, we look at our workstations. We're going to keep those, you know, the CDC requirements and the CDC recommendations in our minds and make sure that we use precautions. Because if we can stay healthy in this building, and then we can also make sure that we can get our products out to be able to protect the public.
It's something, too, that we've always talked about with you and with your predecessors is how the technology changes and how our forecasts of storms has changed. But, you know, does that continue to improve over time, or are we at that point where this is as good as it's going to get in our ability to forecast storms?
Yeah, we still continue to get better with the track forecast. Last season, once again, we saw those improvements. The models continue to get better. I think, you know, when you look at track, I think we've made just incredible strides over the last few decades in the track forecast. But we still have some work to do, because if you think about it, the intensity forecast is still, it still could be troublesome at times. And there, you know, this rapid intensification is a very difficult thing to forecast. There's an interesting statistic that I was looking up, and there's only been four Category 5 storms to make landfall in the continental United States. Every single one of those, 1935, Hurricane Camille, Hurricane Andrew, and also Hurricane Michael, they were all tropical storms just 3 days before landfall. That's a huge stat. So there's still work to do when it comes to intensity. Dorian had several different scenarios that ranged from, you know, moving over Hispaniola would have probably shredded Dorian. It would have been some rain for South Florida, probably Cuba. An in-between solution would have been more of an impact on Florida. And then the right-hand side solution, we got the monster Cat 5 that stalled over the Bahamas. Any one of those solutions could have happened, because there were three centers at the beginning of Dorian that we had the hurricane hunters looking at. So we still have work to do with intensity, that genesis phase. There's still a lot of error associated with the forecast.
And you mentioned you still have the hurricane hunter planes that have been in service for a while. How about other like technologies and drones? How are you using those?
I think one of the exciting things is, you know, we think about, I just mentioned the intensity forecast. I think there's some things about the ocean that we still have to learn. So it's an interesting thing. It, you know, you take the readings, you look at the ocean temperatures, you look at the Gulf, you look at the Atlantic, those sensors are right at the surface. So what's going on underneath? Are we stirring up cold water? Are we stirring up warm water? So we're actually, there's a partnership going on with NOAA, the Navy, others to really put drones. They're called gliders. And they go into the water, and they actually get a profile of temperature, profile of salinity in the actual ocean. That helps us out. That brings some other science data in to really help us understand, you know, really what we're stirring up. Is it changing the water temperature warmer, colder? And that might help us out with intensity forecasting.
Let me finish with this. What is your biggest concern about this upcoming season, considering, again, that these are very, you know, the times we're living in, we're dealing with a lot?
Yeah, there's a lot happening in society, but, you know, hurricane season's upon us. It looks like to be a busy one. And independent of all of that, we still have to know what our risk is. Are we in an evacuation zone? Storm surge causes half the fatalities in these tropical systems. 90% of the fatalities in tropical systems is the water. So I think, you know, with everything going on, we still have to realize we still have risk associated with hurricanes. We still have to prepare for those, and we still have to take the actions to keep ourselves and our families safe with a hurricane.
Kenneth Graham, he's the director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami. Mr. Graham, it's always a pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
And as always, this is hurricane season, so that means it's time to prepare. And if you haven't, again, we have a list to help you. Go to WLRN.org. You can find the list. Now is the time to start getting ready. It's an active, more than active season, more than normal season, I should say, that we're looking forward to. Well, still to come, the Florida Keys are finally open for business, though restricted. Are you going to the Keys, or do you own a business there? We want to hear from you. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, for the past 2 months, the Florida Keys have been closed off to any visitors without a special Keys tag. This, of course, to prevent the coronavirus spread. Thousands have been turned away at the checkpoint at the northern tip of the Overseas Highway. Today, businesses across the 125-mile island stretch open their doors to visitors with restrictions. Tourism, of course, is big business in the Keys. I mean, it generates billions of dollars annually and employs 26,000 people. Joining us now to discuss the reopening is Key West Mayor Terry Johnston. Mayor Johnston, always great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And also joining us is WLRN's Monroe County reporter, Nan Klinger. Nan, thanks so much for being with us. I think I got Nan there, right?
I am here, yes.
Okay, there you go. And by the way, we want to hear from you if you're a business owner in the Keys or if you're someone who plans to visit. Tell us what you are you concerned about and what you're looking forward to. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We did hear from Jeremy Ray on Facebook. He said, the response most people say to me, they're not coming to Key West to spend their money. The mayor just costs lots of more businesses to shut down for good. I hope she's happy. Mayor Johnston, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that. There are people who are very unhappy.
Well, I think there were people that were very unhappy that we closed down at all on March 17th when the virus really hit Key West. But my rationale for doing that is that we're an international destination. After the virus broke out in Hunan, China, we had over 1,300,000 visitors into the city of Key West. And if anybody's ever been to the city of Key West, you know we're a 2x4 island. We're very close. Homes are close. Restaurants are close. So we took extraordinary measures. And those extraordinary measures actually, you know, helped us crush the curve very, very early on in the virus outbreak and kept our hospital staff free so that they could handle the positive cases that we had in-house. And the other part of our decision here to close up very early was the fact that we have a 167-bed hospital with 11 ICU beds and less than 20 ventilators to share among 77,000 people in Monroe County. So all of those factors led to my decision to close up Key West early.
And what were the measures in deciding when to reopen and how to reopen? Yeah.
Well, we knew we needed to open up slowly, and we needed to open up as people were comfortable. That's our goal, is to open up slowly, get our staff trained, get people accustomed to the new protocols, allow them to order in you know, protective equipment, hand sanitizers, no touch temperatures, the materials that they need in order to make people feel safe. Because our philosophy is if people feel safe, they're going to frequent your establishment. If they don't feel safe, they're not going to.
Yeah.
And so that's our philosophy.
And I want to talk about some of these restrictions and how you're going to enforce them. Nan, I mean, you know, you've reported that over this time, thousands of people have been turned away trying to get through that checkpoint. Okay, so now the checkpoint's gone. What did we hear about anything today? Is there like a line of people just excited, ready to get down to the Keys?
What we're hearing is that traffic is heavier than it has been in the Upper Keys, for sure. And Key West is still pretty quiet. I don't know if that's been your observation, Mayor, but that's what I'm hearing. Yeah. You know, I have a friend who owns a guest house down here who says he's got 3 check-ins tonight. I spoke with the manager of a resort in Marathon. They have 70 check-ins, which is a little under half of their total tonight. So people are coming, but it's not the Calgary Stampede, I don't think, no.
And again, we want to hear from business owners or even visitors. You know, what do you expect is going to happen? And what do you hope happens? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN, or just find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. So, Mayor Johnston, again, restrictions in place. You touched on a couple of these. Understanding that, you know, to go into a restaurant or any place of business, you got to have your temperature checked. All right. How's that going to work? And do you think everybody's going to do it?
Well, what we've seen so far, and we've had some businesses that have been opened up for a few weeks now, and most everybody is very agreeable because they're kind of interested in, you know, what their temperature is. And actually, we're having temperatures taken at the door of restaurants. And the reason for that is that when you get in that restaurant, you're going to take off your mask. I mean, when you're walking into a retail operation like Kmart or you know, another retail location, you're going to leave your mask on while you're shopping and as you check out. But in areas where you're going to be taking your mask off in, you know, in a relatively closed situation, we want to make sure that we've taken your temp at the door. And it takes seconds. The majority of the people actually thank you for the additional information, because most people don't walk out of the house taking their temp. So it's an educational process. You know, I'm certainly not saying that we don't have some people who do not want to wear masks, don't want their temperature taken, don't want any restrictions. But our goal is to open up slowly, safely, so that we can stay open, so that we don't see a second surge, and so that we can start to rebuild the economy that we have lost in the last 2 months.
And what about the request for hotels to be at 50% capacity? How do you enforce that?
Well, actually, you know, it's enforced based on check-ins. And we have some, you know, we've talked to our businesses now for about a month and a half. We've had focus groups, you know, we've been talking to them about how you do reopen. And many of these recommendations were theirs. You know, we want to open it up on a very restricted manner so that we can figure out our procedures and policies and make sure that we can social distance on, you know, in common areas of our property. So most of the hotels, I believe, are certainly on board, and the 50% actually came as, you know, recommendations from the hotel association. So they were working on their guidelines much further ahead of us.
And you talked, I mean, look, you talk about trying to open slowly to be safe, but there's still the issue of some people are asymptomatic, and these are not fail-safe ways to always tell. So I mean, there's still a risk.
Well, it is a risk. I mean, it's a risk walking out of your house right now. But the facts are, you know, we've got to get back to business. We have, you know, one of the highest unemployment rates that we have ever had in the state of Florida, and people have got to get back to work. So if that's the case, if we've taken down the informational checkpoint, then let's do it with the very best information and the very best protocols and policies that we can to keep people safe while we're building back our economy.
And Nan, we talked about the people who are coming in, driving into the Keys, but what about folks who are flying into the Keys? Is it still the same restrictions if you're coming in through the airport?
Nope, it is not. They talked about this on the county emergency management call this morning, and basically they're doing the screening for people coming in through general aviation, but for commercial flights, they are not. Previously, anybody coming in on a commercial flight was screened at the airport and asked to self-quarantine for 2 weeks, and now they've dropped that. They say it's because we don't have any direct flights coming from hotspots like New York right now, although know, I'm like, you can just connect and get here. But anyway, that's the protocol now.
I'm talking again with Key West Mayor Terry Johnston, also joining us WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nan Klinger, talking again about the reopening of the Keys. It's now open for business. Restrictions are in place, but you are able to drive in. You're able to go down there now. If you are, tell us what you think. Are you going to make that trip? If you're a business owner, what are you hoping happens? Give us a call, 800-743-9576, or again, find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. We got some comments. Lizzie in Key Largo emailed us. She said, thank you, Mayor, for keeping us safe. Many of us are dreading the reopening and will stay home for the next 2 weeks at least. We also heard from Maria Kalami on Facebook. The entire state should reopen. If COVID doesn't kill us, the economy will. You hear a little bit of everything, Mayor.
Yep, that's the part of being mayor. And you do. We knew We knew very early on that because we were closing up to protect our people and to crush the curve, that it was going to have an economic impact, and we certainly understood that. You know, it's fascinating because when you do get a complaint about wearing a mask, when you do get a complaint about a no-touch temp, it's normally not somebody from Key West. And it's fascinating. As I get these comments, I try and get back and, you know, ask people a little bit about their background and their experiences. But the people of Key West want to stay safe.
Yeah.
The people in Key West understand we're at the bottom. You know, we're at the very tip of Florida. And we're pretty much, you know, we would like to be in control of our own fate here.
I want to go to the phones. I'm going to start with Mary in Pompano Beach. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, I'd like to say, as a South Florida resident, I have enjoyed coming down many, many times. When the roads were closed leading into Key Largo, I was thrilled to think that everybody was going to lock down and take care of themselves. I really appreciate that you all have done that in the Keys. I think Monroe County has been exemplary. I'm an RN. I know what disease control means. So I'm fighting to save their lives, not just during COVID. And I'm very fearful of what's going to happen if we open.
Okay.
I'm in a risk group. I don't want to catch it. Those people that are cavalier and are out there, particularly without their masks.
All right.
They're going to take a chance. So anyway, thank you for all you've done, and I wish you the best of luck in reopening. Thank you.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Excited about the reopening. Still, I mean, as she said, she's part of a group that is at higher risk, but still willing to take that chance. Do you think, I mean, because we've heard from people who said, you know what, even with reopenings, we don't feel safe. And there are a lot of people who are not going to want to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's true, but it's a personal choice. I mean, you have the choice to go out or you have the choice to stay in. You really do. And I, you know, I want to concur because I've heard from a number of locals that said, look, we're just going to let this June 1st thing, you know, come and go. And we're going to let it settle down a little bit, you know, for the novelty of being open for the first time in 2 months. But we've got a lot of locals that are just saying, you know, we're doing just fine. We're just going to wait and see. And we also, I need to tell you, we are also monitoring very, very closely. You know, we know June 1st, we're not going to probably, you know, see any difference in our numbers for at least 2 weeks. And we heard from a physician at our Department of Health this morning who said, you know, we're really probably looking for numbers that change in July,
yeah,
like mid-July. So we are watching for that closely.
Let me get one more call in here. Alexis is in Weston. Alexis, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's really good to be here.
Great. You have a vacation house in the Keys.
Yes, I do.
Are you going down there anytime soon?
So I had been visiting like some weekends just through the checkpoint because I do have my license there. And so we usually go out on the boat through like Caribbean Club or through John Penny Camp because they just recently reopened. But I was wondering, like, what is the best way to go about going to the beach?
All right, Alexis, thank you for the call. The beach, what about that? Everything's open, right?
The beach is wide open, yep. We have been open now. We've had Smathers Beach and Hicks Beach open for about, 3 weeks, right, Nan?
Yeah. May 4th, I think.
Right. Yeah.
All right, so the beaches are open. So, Alexis, if you get down there, that opportunity is there. I got to tell you, I've lived in South Florida now for these last 6 years, and I've only been to the beach a few times, and I miss it a lot. And now all of a sudden I want to go. How ironic, right? You know what? I wanted to get to this point real quickly here. Nan, one of the key drivers of the tourism industry in the Keys is the cruise industry. The millions of people and dollars that come in. And companies are already starting to offer August 1st cruises. But what are some of the changes that are being proposed with the Key West Charter around the cruises?
Yeah, there's a group that's launched a petition drive that wrapped up today, actually. And they want to limit the cruise industry here to 1,500 people a day maximum and ships with no more than a 1,300 person capacity. And give priority to ships with the best environmental and health records.
All right. So that petition ended today. Mayor Johnson, I mean, your response to that, again, big part of the business and the identity of Key West.
Yep, it is a big part of the business. And any referendum by state statute, an elected official is allowed to educate, not advocate for one side or another. So I'm listening to both sides. And, you know, what the positive thing about the COVID-19 outbreak is it did give us all an opportunity to pause and reflect and take a look at our surroundings. And, you know, I think for all of these issues, there's room for compromise. There's certainly room to bring in more environmentally successful ships than what we have in the past. I know we've got improvement there. And we also need to have that economic engine that the cruise industry brings to us. But like everything, there's a compromise.
In 20 seconds, do you think this coronavirus fundamentally reshapes Key West in the economy?
Yes.
Okay, I'll leave it at that.
Yep.
I appreciate the briefness. Key West Mayor Terry Johnson and WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nan Klinger, thank you again so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
And that is Sundial for this Monday, June 1st. Again, June 1st, the start of the hurricane season. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Miami-Dade College has started their summer courses today as well, with the majority of students still studying remote. We're going to learn what Miami-Dade is doing to keep students who have to be on campus safe and, of course, how the pandemic has been impacting their finances. Plus, Ultra Music Festival was among the first major events to be canceled because of the pandemic. Now fans are demanding a refund, and they filed a class action lawsuit. Could other canceled events face legal scrutiny? Finally, a look at the future of sports during the global pandemic. We're going to hear from Miami radio host Joe Rose about what professional sports could look like if we bring it back and nobody is in the stands. Imagine that. That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember, find us at WLRN.org or on social media, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. As always, stay safe, enjoy the reopening, but stay safe. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.